Welcome to the Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shackman. For over half a century, America has been riding a wave of change that began in the tumultuous 1960s. From politics and music to culture and race, the fabric of the nation has been forever transformed. The election of Bill Clinton in 1992 marked the apogee of this era. And while the George W. Bush years felt like a step backwards, Barack Obama's presidency propelled us two steps forward, further reshaping the American landscape. Amid these shifts, media, technology, and globalization have radically altered our world, leaving the past of 60 years ago barely recognizable. Initially, opposition voices found a powerful platform in talk radio, igniting flames of resentment, rage, and bitterness, and they continue to burn. Today, we're going to delve into the heart of this American countryside, fueled by what my guests Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman call white rural rage. Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman examine the paradox of rural white America's significant electoral influence, contrasted with their growing disillusionment. They explore the roots of this discontent, from economic struggles, technological upheavals, cultural shifts, and political manipulation. They argue that the anger simmering in rural communities combined with a demagogue like Donald Trump pose a formidable threat to the very fabric of American democracy. But what does this rural rage mean for the future of our country? How does conservative media keep fueling this fire? And what paths forward, if any, can be envisioned to bridge these deepening divisions? From Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables to the what's the matter with Kansas phenomenon, it is a complex and perhaps unsolvable narrative that has overtaken rural America. Its impact on our national politics and its implications for democracy are profoundly troubling. Tom Schaller is a political science professor at the University of Maryland, and he brings his expertise in U.S. politics and an extensive writing background, including contributions to the New York Times and the Washington Post. Paul Waldman is a journalist and opinion writer whose work has appeared in dozens of newspapers, magazines, and digital outlets. He is a former columnist at the Washington Post and the co-author of four previous books on media and politics. It is my pleasure to welcome Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman here to talk about white rural rage, the threat to American democracy. Paul, Tom, thanks so much for joining us here on the Who, What, Why podcast.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you both here. Paul, I'm going to start with you. The phenomenon of this white rural rage, what we're seeing today, and what Trump has in some ways seemingly unleashed, is a phenomenon that has been building for some 60 years now. Talk about that first.
Absolutely. One of the things that's important to understand is that people in rural America have some legitimate grievances. There has been a real economic decline. In a lot of places, the departure of manufacturing into countries where, you know, you can make tube socks or widgets for a lot cheaper than you can in America, that has left many communities without the jobs that they used to have. In a lot of places that were dependent on resource extraction, basically the resources have all been extracted. You find that in a lot of places in coal country, for instance, that, you know, the companies basically used up all the coal that was there. And there's been, in a lot of places, kind of technological advancements. That coal is a perfect example there, too, where, you know, you don't need to send 1,000 men down into a pit in the ground anymore. You can do most of it with machines and just employ a few people. And there are a lot of things that are kind of endemic to low-density areas that just make life more difficult, that make it harder to access healthcare, that, cause all kinds of problems that over time have kind of built up and up. And a lot of people in rural areas felt that they have been ignored, that their problems are not getting any better. And so you then have a political context where there has been kind of a sort of a hollowing out in rural America of the sort of politics that might actually produce something better for people's lives. And so this is something that has really been exploited very successfully by the Republican Party to say to people, well, look, you know, neither party is really going to give you much when it comes to the material conditions in your community. They're not going to bring the jobs back. They're not going to get you better health care. So all you should concentrate on is these kind of questions of identity. Who is like us? Who is them? Who do you hate? Who says they're on your side? And if you just focus on that, that should be the sum total of your engagement with the political world. And that creates a politics that's really focused on anger and resentment. And it turns out that it's really in the interests of Republicans who keep getting elected in so many rural places over and over and over again, for people to be angry. And as long as they're angry, they're going to keep focusing on these kind of identity politics issues. And they're not going to, as long as they're focused on external people, whether it's immigrants or snooty coastal elitists or, you know, faraway liberals or college professors or whoever it is that they're being told to get mad at, as long as that focus is outside, then they won't say, well, you know, hold on, we keep electing Republicans to every office that represents us, and yet we still have all these kind of really profound problems. Maybe they should be held accountable. That's the last thing that Republicans want, and that their very comprehensive media system, which is its own story that we can talk about, that they want. And so you get a politics that just encourages the legitimate grievances people have and kind of turns them into something that is politically toxic.
And Tom, the irony in all of this is that these white rural voters, or rural voters in general, as a group, have a powerful demographic and political sway, given how many of them there are, given the way our system works, that they could have arguably done something positive with respect to public policy using that influence and political sway that they have, and they've done just the opposite.
That's exactly right, Jeff. You know, a lot of people point out the book and say, how can you discuss rural America generally or white rural Americans specifically and say that they pose a constitutional threat to our democracy? Only 20% of people live in rural areas. A quarter of them, or 5% of the nation overall, are minorities. That means the residual, or 15%, are white and rural. That's about 1 out of 6, 1 out of 7 voters. But as we point out in the book, and specifically in chapter 3, and 4, they have both a what we call either a numerical and notional advantage, or a mathematical and mythological advantage. And we work through those respectively in chapters 3 and 4. And I'll just give you a brief summary of both. First of all, thanks to Senate malapportionment, smaller states and therefore by extension, rural states and rural white states, particularly non-college rural whites, are vastly overrepresented in the Senate. You know, Wyoming, the smallest state, had 584,000 people at the last census, and California had 39 million. That's a 68-to-1 ratio, but their ratio in the House is only 52-to-1, and their ratio in the Electoral College is only 54-to-3, or 18-to-1. So there are 68 Californians for every Wyomingite, but they only cast 18 times the electoral votes. And because of the concentration of white rural, particularly white rural non-college educated people in smaller states, it builds in an advantage in both the Senate and the presidency. And if you doubt me, just ask President Al Gore or President Hillary Clinton, or consider the fact that the Democrats have won the popular vote in 7 of the 8 previous electoral national popular votes. But of course, have only won the Electoral College 5 of those 8 times. The Democrats, by the time Biden's first term ends here, will have served 20 years out of those 32, and will have gotten 5 Supreme Court appointments. And in the 12 years with only 1 popular vote win, that would be Bush's reelection in 2004, the Republicans have had 5 appointments to the Supreme Court as well. So despite winning 7/8 of the popular votes, the Democrats have had 50% of the last 10 Supreme Court appointments, and the Republicans have had the other 50%. So you can see that there's the magnification numerically of conservative and especially rural white power based on the structure of institutions. And then the second point that we make as a follow-up in chapter 4 is that they have this mythological advantage. We don't want to say they're not criticized, but there's a bit of a deference, a kid glove treatment, particularly when it comes to transgressions of rural white Americans, because they're considered more real than other people, that they're the heartland folks who love their country and love their God and their families and leave their doors unlocked and help out a neighbor. And some of that is certainly true, though they don't attend church any more regularly than people in the cities, according to the Cooperative Election Study. But this notion that you have to constantly fawn over and lionize And worse, excuse transgressions, particularly small d democratic transgressions of rural white Americans because they're somehow better than other people is absurd. Our standard, as we joke, is the Tina Fey standard. I call her my TV girlfriend. In 30 Rock, she says, you know, there's nobody's more real than anybody else. And in our view, a 65-year-old white male evangelical Christian father and grandfather who lives in Northwest Iowa, who's a vet, is no more or no less real than a 22-year-old Afro-Latina single woman who's a lesbian who lives in, you know, Brooklyn and is getting her art history master's and Ubering at night to pay her way through college. Everybody, as Tina Fey, just wants to have a sandwich and a Diet Sprite and be left alone for lunch. And that's kind of our standard. The sandwiches may differ depending on whether you're eating a po' boy in Louisiana or a submarine in Albany, New York, where I grew up, or a hoagie, depending on what part of the country you live in. But this notion that somehow white rural voters are better than the rest of the people, we're not saying they're any worse, we're just saying they're not any better than any other Americans, but they do continue to wield inflated power in the Electoral College, in the Senate, and as we prove in Chapter 3, they actually have inflated power in the House of Representatives too.
And it all falls under the rubric of what you talk about is this patriot paradox. Paul, talk about that.
Yeah, this is something that is also part of that rural ethos and part of why it's part of rural people's self-conception and also how the rest of the country views them and often why in politics they are given that kind of extra deference. The idea is that rural people are particularly patriotic. They have flags on their porches. They send their sons and sometimes daughters to the military at higher rates, and that's true. But that's just one element of patriotism. It's not how vigorously you wave the flag. It's also whether you support the core institutions of democracy. And those institutions are now under threat. And all too often, as we say, the stance of many in rural America is, I love my country, but I'm not so sure about our country. And you can call yourself a patriot, but if you think that it's appropriate to dismantle this system that we have lived with for 2.5 centuries, then there's something really wrong there. And this gets to, I think, why it's so important to reckon with the support of rural Americans for Donald Trump, who is, as we all, I think, understand, the most profound threat that American democracy has faced in, you know, probably since the Civil War. I mean, you have someone who is not only, of course, a xenophobe and a bigot and all the other things and a conspiracy theorist, but he is also someone who is on a near daily basis announcing his intentions to take an axe to all of the institutions that have sustained us. And Trump's support in rural America among rural whites is truly extraordinary, and it's getting bigger. In 2016, he got 62% of the votes of rural whites. In 2020, he got 71%, and it'll probably be higher this time. We looked, for instance, at his the 100 counties where he performed the best in 2016, and they're basically all rural. They tend to be smaller counties. There are places where he got 80, 85, even 90% of the vote. And in 91 out of those 100 counties, he did better in 2020 than he had in 2016 as the rest of the country was moving away from him. And so this is the heart of Donald Trump's support. And so you have people, millions of them, who are fervent in their insistence that they are not just patriotic, but the most patriotic of Americans. And yet they are worshipful of this candidate who is unadorned in his intentions to turn America into something in terms of its government that may not be unrecognizable, but that is not going to be nearly as democratic as it is right now. And who, let's not forget, led an insurrection to overthrow the United States government. And I don't think that's an exaggeration to put it that way. And so that has not diminished his supporters among rural whites, as far as we can tell. And as I said, I would not be surprised if the 71% support he got among rural whites in 2020 turns into 73, 74, 75% in 2024. And so I think that it's important to understand patriotism in a more comprehensive way than just, do you have a flag on your porch? Does that matter? Sure, it matters. But it has to be something more than just saying you love America. You have to demonstrate it. And this is where I think one of the points of our book is that there is a threat to American democracy. And it's not only coming from rural places. There are plenty of people who have thin and weakening commitments to democracy who live in suburbs and who live in cities. And there are plenty of people in rural America who really are committed to American democracy and who don't believe some of the problematic things that we discuss in the book. That's important to understand. But that support for those problematic ideas and for the threats that are coming to American democracy are higher in rural areas, and they constitute really the base of the base of Trump's support. So that's why we call it a patriotic paradox.
And Tom, talk about the things that are really adding to this divide, the wealth gap, which we hear talked about a lot, certainly, and the education gap, and the way in which so much of this has moved away from policy issues to things that actually might help rural America to really focus on the cultural issues.
Yeah, as Paul alluded to, we talk about the threats that are coming from white rural America, again, not exclusively and not uniformly, but predominantly, or sort of the leading edge or the tip of the spear of this threat. And in the middle of the book, we talk about four compounding factors that sort of magnify these threats of anti-democratic and racist xenophobic attitudes and conspiracism and weakening commitments to democratic traditions and norms. I already discussed too in my previous answer the fact that rural white voters have an inflated electoral power and that they have this inflated mythologized notional power. The other two that we talk about, and Paul just alluded to one, is this sort of triggering of rural white America by elites, and particularly by Donald Trump and the MAGA coalition, who emphasize, as you point out, Jeff, cultural issues. And if you start from the assumption, as we do, or as we conclude, that rural white Americans have rightly, let's be clear, rightly concluded that neither party can really save them economically. You can't vote in Congress to ban China from creating goods at cheaper rates because they use child labor and don't have labor unions or environmental protections. You can't legislate away technological changes, as Paul alluded to, that remove coal jobs and replace them with, you know, mountaintop removal and giant cranes instead of workers with pickaxes and shovels. And so as the post-extractive, post-industrial, late-stage capitalism economy of rural America, which is replacing mom-and-pop shops with dollar stores, is squeezing local public revenues and budgets for, you know, towns and counties. Kids are being brain drained out and being told, as 60% of rural adults, we point out, tell their children to leave. And so the best and the brightest go on to a state university or a nice liberal arts college or an Ivy League school if they can get in, and they become doctors and lawyers and accountants and engineers. And then they, you know, have to almost go to the cities and suburbs to pay back their student loans and so forth. There's this anxiety, resentment. Really, we call it rage in the title, but we're really talking about a definable, quantifiable social science construct called white resentment in the rural areas. And Republican politicians aren't stupid. They may be mendacious. They may do things like J.D. Vance did when he basically lied about his own mother and claimed that it was Mexican immigrants coming over the border with a Democratic registration card in one hand, a lie, and a bag of fentanyl, in the other hand, also a lie. The vast majority, more than 90% of the fentanyl, is brought across the border by American citizens. But if you can trigger people and their fear of immigrants, if you can trigger people and their fear of some trans rights activist or some trans girl wanting to play on a soccer team, if you can trigger people by critical race theory or Black Lives Matter or whatever the boogeyman of the month is, as dreamt up by, you know, Chris Rufo at the Heritage Foundation and other such people and their media echo chamber on Fox and the conservative national conservative talk radio network, you can get people to vote. And you can argue rationally, let me be clear, you could argue rationally that, you know, if you're a rural white person who doesn't see any difference whatsoever between the Democratic and the Republican Party on economics, you might as well vote for the Republican Party, because at least they're promising and have delivered in Dobbs to reverse Roe v. Wade. And you might as well vote for them because they're going to be more hardline on immigrants and support a Muslim ban and try to restrict people coming in from shithole countries, as Donald Trump promised. There's a certain rationality to that vote if you've essentially, as you pointed out, your institutions, including your schools, including your economies, have been gutted and eviscerated. You might as well just vote as a tiebreaker on cultural issues and cultural resentments.
And yet on the economic issues, things that might have helped them, whether it's Medicaid expansion under Obamacare or child tax credit or more education funding, they're constantly doing things that are anathema to their own economic interest.
Yeah, that's true in a lot of ways. Medicaid expansion is a perfect example. I mean, you still have 10 states, 10 Republican-run states that have not accepted the expansion of Medicaid. And who gets hurt worse by that? It's rural Americans. The lack of access to healthcare is an enormous problem in rural America. Over the last 20 years, almost 200 rural hospitals have closed. And this is something we found as we traveled around and reported from different places in rural places all over the country. People told us again and again that it was such a problem that, you know, one county supervisor in North Carolina was talking about this at a time they finally accepted the expansion of Medicaid after 10 years of arguing about it in North Carolina. But at the time when we were there, it was the argument in the legislature was still going on. And she said to us with this kind of note of desperation in her voice, "We need it. We need it." She said, not only do we not have a hospital in this county, we don't even have an urgent care center. If you break your ankle, you're going to have to get in your car and drive a half an hour to get care, let alone if you're having a heart attack, right? And so this is a huge issue all over rural America. And the Republicans who run so many of these states have refused to accept the expansion of Medicaid that rural hospitals rely on, and it is literally a life and death issue. And they tell people that, oh, well, you know, this is going to be socialism and big government. And the result is that millions of rural Americans don't have health insurance and don't have access to care anywhere nearby their communities. And, you know, somehow they've been convinced that to accept that expansion where the federal government pays 90% of the cost, well, that must just be doing a favor for Barack Obama. And so we certainly don't want to do that. And so, you know, this is an example of how the Republicans who represent so many rural Americans, especially white rural Americans, are constantly doing things that undermine their prospects and their communities. And somehow they keep getting away with it. I'll give you one more example. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott has a school voucher plan that he has been pushing really, really hard. And the thing about school vouchers is that they don't do anything for people in rural areas. Why? Because there aren't private schools there. Even if you wanted to use a voucher, you couldn't. And people in rural areas rely on their public schools as the center of their community. And so you have Governor Abbott in Texas working hard to get this voucher plan passed. And for a change, an unusual occurrence, the Republicans who represent rural areas in the state legislature got together with Democrats to stop that bill. And so now Abbott is trying to target those Republicans for primary challenges from even more right-wing Republicans so that he can pass his voucher plan, which would hurt their rural constituents. And we see versions of that all over the country that, you know, in these places, people are represented from top to bottom. Every office they see on their ballot, whether it's United States Senator, all the way down to dog catcher, they're all Republicans. And they're not doing much to help them in the conditions of their lives. And you see this kind of, I mentioned this sort of hollowing out of politics, that there's no Democratic Party presence, and there's also no real Republican Party presence. It's easy for those Republicans to keep getting elected and elected and elected because people have decided that the Democratic Party they're just not people like us. And therefore, we'll just keep electing these Republicans. But what we won't do is hold them accountable for whether or not they are actually doing anything for us.
And Tom, to what extent does the fact that urban America, the blue states, see this trend that we've been talking about, they see what's going on and realize that as a rule, they're not doing anything, rural America's not doing anything to help itself, and it just adds to the divide?
Well, I don't know. We don't really poll or look at the attitudes of urban America. And I don't know if the animosity is shared. I mean, we do cite one poll where rural Americans and urban Americans view the city and country as different from each other. And it's 20% higher in terms of rural folks viewing the city as sort of foreign than the share of city folk that view the country as foreign. And it's hard to unpack exactly what they mean by that. But we know what the origins of rural resentment are. They come from a sense that the government is built in the state capitals in Washington, and it's focused on those cities and big cities and minority areas, and that rural America gets nothing, no attention, no power, no services, even though there are 400 federal programs specifically dedicated to varieties of rural life and not just agriculture, although 70 of those 400 are at the USDA. They include, you know, everything from electrification and broadband and transportation and sewage treatment facilities to education and grants and community colleges and a variety of other programs to help rural America. In any event, I don't know if the animosity is similar. I'm sure that, you know, certainly on election day, when the more numerous and overwhelmingly blue cities see that they cast more votes for Hillary Clinton or Al Gore, but somehow are watching the swearing in of the guy, Trump or Bush 43, take office despite getting fewer votes, I'm sure there's a certain degree of chafing at that prospect. And perhaps the gerrymandering on the state level, which, as Paul pointed out, has still allowed, you know, 10 states to block the Medicaid expansion of Obamacare, which would bring significant relief and lower the uninsured rates in those states where they expanded, based on what we know from the states that did adopt that. The Kentucky versus Tennessee example that Jonathan Metzl, who wrote, you know, Dying from Whiteness, made very clear that Kentucky's health metrics and insurance rates both improved when it adopted Medicaid right out of the box, the Obamacare Affordable Care Act expansion, whereas Tennessee, its neighboring state, which has a similar demographic profile, is still one of the 10 states, along with Texas and Mississippi and others, and Wisconsin. They're all red states, except for Wisconsin, which is the most purple state, refused to do so. So I don't know if there's an urban angst. There's probably a little bit of, maybe a lot of political frustration at these imbalances. But we really, unfortunately, don't focus on that. So I feel a little unable to answer that question with any authority. I'm sorry, Jeff.
It comes out as Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables. I mean, you see elements of that in that statement.
Hillary Clinton did not say rural or white. We often point out that nobody insulted Trump's voters, because we get this question all the time. What about Hillary's, you know, that deplorable comment is, first of all, it's MAGA broad. It's not rural specific. But even if we say, as we do, that the core of Trump's MAGA coalition is white rural America, they did vote not just 62% in 2016. They made the most dramatic move to Trump after 4 years. They voted 71% for him 4 years later. No group moved faster or farther toward Trump in 4 years than rural white Americans. That's a fact. So let's say, for the sake of example, she was thinking of white rural Americans, the base of Trump's base. You know, when Donald Trump said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue in broad daylight without, you know, not under self-defense, and I wouldn't lose a single voter. Think about what that implies. He's saying my supporters are so morally bankrupt, they're so ethically depraved, that they would vote for a murderer for president. If Hillary Clinton said that, you'd hear that comment repeated time after time. We've had conservative talk hosts try to catch us off guard by playing that clip. And if Hillary Clinton had said that, that would have been worse than anything she said in terms of deplorables. I'm not justifying her critique of people as deplorable. But Trump said that. He laughed. His voters laughed. And then they went out in November and proved him right and voted for him in the tens of millions. They basically said, yeah, we are that depraved. We will vote for a murderer. We will vote for a guy who grabs and buys, you know, the generals. We will vote for a guy who cheats on all his wives, including with a porn star 5 months after she's given birth. We will vote for a guy who cheats carpenters and electricians and plumbers and drywallers as part of his business model. We will vote for a guy who makes fun of, you know, Mexicans as rapists and murderers. We will vote for somebody who's so abased, who is so, like, morally bankrupt, because that's who we are, too. If she had said that, she would have been crucified. But Trump says it, and they laugh, and they voted for him.
Isn't that further evidence, Paul, of just how wide this divide is, and how impossible it seems, at least on the surface, to ever bridge it?
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons, I think, for instance, that, you know, people say, well, why doesn't Joe Biden get more credit for the things that he's doing for red states? And he, you know, for instance, is spending tens of billions of dollars to extend broadband to underserved areas, including a lot of rural areas. And that's really important to economic development and also just the quality of people's lives. But he doesn't get a lot of credit. And the kind of primary reason is that all politics is identity politics. It's about who am I and who is they, and where can you draw that line, erect that wall? And this is something that Republicans have been very successful at in rural areas, of basically saying Democrats are not like you. They are this other kind of people, and you should never, ever even consider voting for them, no matter what they might do for you, because they're just not your kind of people. That is an extremely powerful argument. And one of the things that political scientists have found in recent years is that party identification has become a storehouse for all kinds of identity. It's not just your preference. It's not like, oh, you know, I like the Red Sox and you like the Yankees, or I like chocolate ice cream and you like vanilla ice cream. It gets to kind of a profound sense of who you are. And what sorts of people are your people and what sorts of people are not your people. And it's very, very difficult to break through that. But I don't think we should give up hope. And that's why we say near the end of the book, you know, we're not saying that all rural Americans should just vote for Democrats. You know, maybe some of them should. But at the very least, they need to get themselves some better Republicans. And that would be a really good start to force the people who they keep electing to not just say, oh, I'm like you and I hate the same people you hate, but to also say, here's what I'm going to do to address these problems that we have here. And if the rural voters began to do that, then you'd begin to see more political competition in primary campaigns, and politicians would have to say what they're going to do, and then they would have to deliver. And if you held them accountable, then maybe they wouldn't get reelected if they didn't deliver. And you would also, I think, open up a space more for Democrats to start to be able to make those arguments too, to kind of, you know, to break through that wall of identity. If there was a conversation happening in Republican primaries about who's going to bring back some economic opportunity to our community, who's going to solve the problem of our crumbling infrastructure, who's going to make sure that we do have access to healthcare, and Republicans had to address those issues, then that would open up a space for Democrats to come into those same places and say, hey, look, you know, we have some pretty good ideas on this too. And okay, maybe you don't agree with us on abortion, and that's okay. But here's some things that we might do to actually help. If you could open up that space a little bit, I think Democrats would have some more success, even if they might not win in rural communities. Maybe instead of getting 30% of the vote, they might get 35%, which could be meaningful in statewide contests. And it has at some times and in some places. But it would begin to kind of just sort of enhance the nature of the political discussion. And that's one of the things that I think is a real tragedy, is that politics has become so hollow in so many rural places. There's no competition. The Democratic Party doesn't have a presence. The Republican Party doesn't have a presence. And people don't see the political realm as a place that they can enter and engage with and begin to solve problems. And that's really a tragedy for those communities. It's also a gift to Republicans who don't really have to do much for them. But that, I think, is the first part of the answer, for real people to start demanding more of the politicians they elect. And then that's going to open up the space for a wider kind of conversation.
Doesn't that mean, though, Tom, of moving a 60-year trend backwards, moving from identity and identity and identity to policy once again?
I mean, of course it means that, but can you achieve it? Can you affect it? I mean, Ezra Klein's book, Why We're Polarized, in Chapter 5, which I assigned to my students in Poly 100, argues, and I agree with Ezra, that, you know, demographic change is the single biggest underlying driver of everything that's happening in American politics, which is just another way of saying that, not that demography is the entirety of identity, but it's a big part of identity, that the demographic changes are driving identity politics, and we're pluralizing as a country. We're becoming more heterogeneous, and obviously on race, most specifically, but on gender and gender identity and other factors as well. And as that happens, the big question that faces democracy, the existential question, is whether or not we can digest those changes without tearing ourselves apart. And so far, at least, the answer is no. I mean, it's not happening. Blue and red America are moving farther and farther away from us. It started at the sort of state level with blue states and red states and the decline of purple states. We only have 8 or 10 states at most that are really competitive in presidential elections. The number of states that have a split pair of U.S. senators from different parties is down to 5. It's like Wisconsin, Montana, Ohio, used to be Pennsylvania till Fetterman won. Almost every state produces two senators from the same party and its electoral votes for that same party as well. We have way more unified governments at the state level, where the governor and the state Senate and the state House are all controlled trifectas, as they call them, by the same party. And so blue America is getting bluer, red America is getting redder. And now it's happening on the county level, which is really remarkable. And so, you know, people are voting with their feet, or whatever you call it, moving to like-minded communities to be at places where they share, you know, an identity and an ideology. And, you know, there's a lot of talk of, we're in the middle of a soft civil war. I think we already are in one. And I don't know how we reverse that, because we can't reverse engineer the demographic changes that are A, happening and are going to continue to happen as we move forward. And so America has to decide, frankly, whether or not what's most important is the secular constitutional religion to which people, when they hold up their hand on the Bible and take their citizenship exam, or even if they were born here, commit themselves to our secular pluralist constitutional democracy. And that is their religion, so to speak. I sound like, George Clooney in that political movie, but, right. In all seriousness, what should matter most to Americans is not who you look, think, act, or pray to, but whether you share that identity as an American, that core patriotism. And what we're seeing is the disintegration of people, of the commitments of some people, not all of whom are rural white, and not all rural white Americans, who are losing that attachment because they see changes in the country. And as Paul pointed out, and you asked us earlier, that paradox is they beat their chest claiming that, as a Lee Greenwood song plays on the speaker at a football stadium, saying that they love the flag more than Colin Kaepernick, and denigrating others' patriotism when in fact they have some of the weakest commitments. You know, Colin Kaepernick takes a knee peacefully and he's considered somebody who hates America, but people who removed the flag from the Capitol on January 6th and replaced it with a Trump flag, a Trump 2020 flag, and were marching around the city where I live and where my taxes pay for our DC police officers, are marching around with US flags that have Donald Trump's face with a Rambo bandana superimposed on a very slick and oiled up semi-homoerotic Sylvester Stallone Rambo torso. And that image is superimposed onto the stars and stripes. Those people are considering, or at least consider themselves, patriots. So the definition of who can desecrate our flag has polarized as well. And I think this is an unfortunate reality. And until we do something about it, and I don't think you can just reverse engineer the demographic changes, and so I'm not sure what the solution is here, we're going to continue to have this bifurcated red-blue America, and it could spell disaster. I hope not. You know, Paul and I talk a lot about how we hope we're wrong long-term about this book. We hope that rural white America, or rural America generally, is clawed back from the Democratic precipice and returns to its commitments to the country with the same full throaty voice that they are now calling for a guy who wants to be dictator for a day. We hope in 10 or 15 years, people say this book is obsolete. That'll be a win for democracy, even if it's a loss for white rural rage.
Finally, Paul, I have the last word on this because we're out of time. Many other changes that are taking place, technological changes and more demographic changes, are all adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah, absolutely they are. And this is something that there is no, one kind of easy solution to creating a new vibrant economies in rural places. Some places have been successful if they have some kind of natural resource that maybe, brings in people who, maybe there's a lake nearby and people like to go boating, and then that creates some economic vitality there. But a lot of places don't have that. Some places have said, we want to welcome in immigrants because we're losing population. And that has happened in a lot of rural places. Something like 2/3 of rural counties lost population between the 2010 and 2020 censuses. And so there are places that have said, we need more population. We're going to bring in immigrants. They're going to start businesses. And that has really worked in some places. But we're in an era of rapid technological change. And, there is no one easy solution. The Biden administration, for example, has a whole industrial policy that is based on promoting certain industries in places that have largely been left behind. And that is, it's going to take a while to bear fruit, and it's not going to go into every corner of America. But, that's a partial solution. But this is going to continue to be a problem, because just the fact of low density and in some cases kind of isolation from larger metropolitan areas creates just really real economic challenges that are extremely difficult to overcome. And so you need to have kind of all hands on deck to try to create a vibrant economic future. And unfortunately, too often, people just want to be told that, you know, oh, we're going to bring all the coal jobs back, as Donald Trump told people in West Virginia, or, you know, that we can just make America great again and kind of wind the clock back to the 1950s and have those things at the same time as Republicans, for instance, are, you know, trying to destroy collective bargaining and unions in America, which is one of the only things that ever brought prosperity and security to a lot of these places. So it is an extraordinarily complex problem, and there is no one easy solution. It's going to take decades to solve. The more that people in rural America are told to marinate in a kind of toxic politics of resentment, the more difficult it is going to be to find those solutions and to have everybody has an interest in bringing rural America up to a place where they do have security and prosperity. That's what we have to do. We have to think about it as a common fate that we all have together. And it's not zero sum, but the problems are not going to be easy to solve. But, you know, it's already too late to get started.
Tom Schaller, Paul Waldman. The book is White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Tom, Paul, I thank you both so much for spending time with us today here on the Who, What, Why podcast.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you. Cheers. And thank you for listening and joining us here on the Who, What, Why podcast. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Schaller. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.